Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca, in for Ira Flatow. People with severe nausea or debilitating muscle spasms may find standard medication doesn't work for them. Some of these patients have tried smoking marijuana to ease their symptoms. Sometimes their doctors have encouraged them to, and sometimes it seems to work. But there are a lot of questions about using marijuana as a medical therapy. There are doubts about the long-term safety of marijuana, and it's difficult to supply in a controlled dose. That hasn't stopped 10 states, as well as the federal government of Canada, from passing laws making it easier for patients to get the illegal drug. This hour, we'll be talking about what scientists already know about marijuana and what they'd still like to know. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guests. Billy Martin is professor and chair in the Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology at the Medical College of Virginia. He joins us from the studios of WCVE in Richmond. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Igor Grant is professor of psychiatry and director of the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research at the University of California at San Diego. He joins us from the studios of the BBC in Berlin, Germany. Welcome to the program. And finally, John Benson is professor and dean emeritus at the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon, and was co-principal investigator of the 1999 report by the Institute of Medicine, Marijuana and Medicine, Assessing the Scientific Base. He joins us from his office in Portland.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So, Dr. Benson, if I can start with you, why was the government, or first of all, who asked for this Institute of Medicine study that you were the co-principal investigator on? What were they supposed to be finding, and who asked for it?
It was the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under General McCaffrey at the time that sought the advice of the Institute of Medicine to review the scientific evidence to assess the potential both benefits and risks of marijuana and its constituent cannabinoids. And that study was funded and entirely independent, was conducted, I should say, and funded by the Institute of Medicine. I think it came in the wake of several state medical marijuana initiatives, both referenda and legislation. As you say, now up to 10 states. There were about 6 or 7 at the time, and possibly also the growing popularity of alternative or complementary medicine, where advocates of personal choice, with a growing distrust of scientific and technological medicine, sought alternatives congruent with their own values about health and life.
And I gather that you were not a particularly expert in this field, so you came to it more or less as a fresh eye. At the end of the study, where did you think things stood? Was this research? I mean, was there evidence for marijuana to be valuable or not?
It's certainly a powerful drug and produces a variety of biological effects. And from a medical standpoint, we felt that its effects were limited to symptom relief and generally modest, but for certain patients, as you suggest, these drugs do appear to hold potential for treating certain symptoms such as pain, the nausea and vomiting from chemotherapy, and wasting caused by AIDS or advanced cancer.
Well, let me turn to Dr. Grant now. I gather that this is an area of continuing interest for you in San Diego. What are you doing in terms of testing marijuana?
Well, first of all, maybe your listeners might need a bit of background. The state of California passed one of these initiatives that was referred to earlier that wished to provide people with certain conditions access to marijuana as a medicine if physicians felt it was indicated. And then following up on that, the legislature in California and the governor signed legislation that established a Center for Research on Medicinal Cannabis at the University of California, and I direct that. It's actually a University of California-wide center, not it's centered in San Diego, but applies to the entire university. And the idea of the center was really to begin modern-day clinical trials on this, and the Institute of Medicine report was one of several documents that our center used to identify areas of potential interest. What we do is we ask physician scientists to submit proposals to us for clinical trials, for example, in conditions such as painful peripheral neuropathy or
severe... What's that, peripheral neuropathy? What's that?
Let me define that. Well, for example, some people with advanced HIV disease, AIDS, or people with diabetes, or people that have suffered crush injuries of their limbs, develop a severe kind of pain that can be disabling and in many cases is not very well treated by traditional or the medicines that are available now, such as the opioid analgesics. And there's some evidence from the animal literature that this type of pain may be relieved by cannabinoids. And so this painful peripheral neuropathy is one of the conditions that we have studies ongoing in. Another area is spasticity related to multiple sclerosis. Again, there's some literature, particularly in the animal area, that suggests there might be relief of painful spasms. And so we have two studies, one ongoing and one about to start in this area. I think Dr. Benson also mentioned the areas of nausea and vomiting, as part of cancer or cancer chemotherapy. There are studies beginning on that, as well as wasting and weight loss.
So this is a pretty active research portfolio. How many people are we talking about?
We're talking about, at the moment, about 500 participants will be studied once the studies are fully ongoing, and it will be in several studies. It's they're not 500 in one particular study, but there are actually 10 clinical studies that will be ongoing once we get going.
I'd like to turn to Dr. Billy Martin now, because I'd like you, sir, to explain what a cannabinoid is and what the relationship is between the marijuana that people smoke and the cannabinoid that people think might have a benefit.
Yes. Marijuana is composed of a class of compounds that we call cannabinoids. A cannabinoid, the definition of cannabinoid is really cannabis-like. So cannabis is the name of the general class that marijuana is in. And so of these substances we call cannabinoids that appear in marijuana, there's one primary constituent, delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, that we believe is responsible for the behavioral effects as well as the potential medical effects. And so most of the research over the years is concentrated on delta-9 THC, either as a abuse potential or as a potential medical therapy.
And why abuse potential? Where does that what is it about the cannabinoids that makes them gives them the potential for abuse?
Well, certainly we know that marijuana is self-administered, and the fact that some people develop dependence to it. It's a rewarding, obviously it affects their reward systems, and a lot of the new science is pointing to cannabinoids, and the science behind it is also might be involved in other drugs of abuse as well.
I see. And what about the benefits? I mean, is there some biomedical pathway or something in the brain that suggests why a cannabinoid should relieve nausea or should relieve pain?
Exactly. In the last decade or so, we've made tremendous progress in understanding the biology of marijuana or the biological system upon which marijuana produces its effect. And it's been very exciting because we now know that there's a specific, unique biological system whereby marijuana acts on that system. It's like many of the neurotransmitters that we already know, like dopamine, serotonin, and so forth. There's a unique receptor that cannabinoids act on. There are naturally occurring substances that produce cannabinoid-like effects. And so this entire system there is modulating a lot of other neurotransmitter systems. And so the real challenge today is to really elucidate the physiological role of this system. What is it doing there? And by chance, marijuana activates that system.
All right. I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation. Our number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And why don't we go to Paul in San Francisco? Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I'm a physician here in San Francisco. I work in HIV and general medicine in homeless programs for the health department. And I should say, having said that, I'm speaking for myself and not for my employer. I have started to have the experience pretty consistently that I have patients coming and asking for medical marijuana who, in fact, don't have any of the limited indications for medical marijuana and who are really not prepared to hear no as an answer. And I've started to sort of see this as, pardon me, as I see them sort of coming down the hall with the, you know, with the form in their hand, I started to sort of feel like a torpedo is coming at me. You know, I'm working with people who are, you know, have often had very difficult relationships with physicians and are often very distrustful with physicians, and I'm working really hard to try to build up a trusting relationship. And then I'm put in this position where often not only do they not have an indication for medical cannabis, they also have reasons why they shouldn't smoke marijuana. And sometimes they've even been cases where I've, you know, discussed my concern about the person's use of marijuana, and, you know, and then they put this form in front of me that requires me to say either I've recommended or that I don't object to its use. And I often, you know, there are times that I can't even finish this sentence, you know, to say that I'm not sure this is the best thing for you before there's, you know, an explosive reaction. And I've had it happen more than once that terminates the relationship. So I've come to have some pretty powerfully ambivalent feelings about it. I absolutely acknowledge that there are some cases where, you know, where it's an absolute last resort, you know, this may be useful. You know, at the same time, I've started to see a tremendous harm in the patient, in the physician-patient relationship by the existence of this law.
Dr. Grant, I don't mean for you to speak for the state of California, but you work there. Have you experienced anything like this?
Well, as I've described, we're actually doing clinical trials research, and rather than, you know, primary care at the front line, as your caller is doing apparently. I think that from a medical standpoint, it is important to separate out the social and political dialogue from the medicine and physiology of cannabis. It may well be the case that there are, given what Dr. Martin said, that there are physiological systems that respond to the cannabinoids. They're there for a reason.
Excuse me, Dr. Grant, I'm sorry I have to cut you off here because we have to take a short break, but we'll be right back. Please stay with us.
Okay.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about medical marijuana. My guests are John Benson from the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Billy Martin from the Medical College of Virginia, and Igor Grant, who's at the University of California at San Diego. And when we started into the break, we were asking, Dr. Grant was answering a question about the possibly inappropriate need that some people might have for or desire to have marijuana.
Yeah, right. And what I was just trying to say is it's important to separate out the social kind of political aspects of marijuana from the medical aspects to the extent that we can. And I was beginning to say that Dr. Martin had mentioned that we now know that there are systems within the body, within the brain and other organ systems that respond to the cannabinoids. And in fact, we have our own internal signaling molecules or chemicals that kind of mimic what marijuana does. So there's a reason for all of those things. And we know from other experience that when such systems exist, probably they can be modified both to produce health benefits and sometimes ill consequences as well. So I think what we're trying to do is to see whether this is a class of chemicals that might have some special benefit for patients who are not responding to other kinds of therapies. And but the in a way, the argument could be that some of the initiatives are putting the cart before the horse a little bit, in the sense that we don't yet know whether these compounds will be effective. Now, there are many reasons why we don't know that yet, but until we know, it might be premature.
Okay, I'd like to bring on another guest for an update on the situation north of the border. Canada, as I said earlier, is planning to provide patients with federally approved medicinal marijuana. Mary Lynch is Associate Professor of Psychiatry, Anesthesia, and Pharmacology at Dalhousie University and Director of Research in the Pain Management Unit of Queen Elizabeth II Health Sciences Center in Halifax, Nova Scotia. She's also director of the Canadian Consortium for the Investigation of Cannabinoids in Human Therapeutics. Welcome to the program, Dr. Lynch.
Good afternoon.
So, would you be our surrogate here and explain the new Canadian policy on behalf of the government?
Well, the medical marijuana access regulations have been around since approximately July of 2001. So, patients have been able to apply for medical access to marijuana since somewhat before that time, actually, because prior to that there was another regulation that patients could use. What is new is the Government of Canada has now come out with an interim policy to provide either seeds or actual marijuana to patients who have been approved for medical use under certain circumstances.
And what sorts of circumstances?
Well, there's been this catch-22 since the introduction of the MMAR regulations. Where
remind me what that acronym stands for.
Marijuana Medical Access Regulation.
Okay.
MMAR.
Got it.
Yes. There has been a catch-22 where patients can get approved to possess and can apply for licenses to grow marijuana for medicinal purposes, but they have not had any way to obtain a legal supply. This new policy is an attempt to, at least on an interim basis, provide seeds so that those who have been licensed to grow can grow, and to provide actual marijuana to those who are unable to grow or who are unable to find a designated person to grow for them.
I see. And I gather that, like California, which has established a research program into the effects of medical marijuana or marijuana as a therapeutic, Canada and you also have started a project like that. Is that right?
Yes. The Government of Canada, through Health Canada, has established a medical marijuana research program to support and facilitate studies examining whether or not marijuana has any therapeutic benefit.
And have you had any preliminary results, or can you tell us what direction your research is going in?
Well, at present, the majority of research that we have done has consisted of survey types of studies where we've asked our patients in different settings, for example, our pain management unit setting and also our MS clinic setting, if they are using and why they are using and whether or not it is helpful and what symptoms is it helpful for. And our survey studies have told us that somewhere around 10% of our patients with pain and 14% of our patients with MS are using marijuana with good effect for various symptoms, including pain and spasticity, and decreased appetite and anorexia, nausea, vomiting.
So it may be that the rationale for using marijuana is becoming clearer, according to what you're finding.
Well, certainly our patients are telling us in survey studies that they are finding it helpful where they've not found other prescription medications helpful. But I just caught the tail end of Dr. Igor Grant's comments regarding the need that we have for additional randomized controlled trials examining this question more closely. Survey studies and open trials cannot really answer the question of efficacy. We need a randomized controlled trial to tell us that.
Okay, well, and presumably those are being initiated.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what the California Research Program is sort of working towards doing that and actually doing that. And the Canadian program has the same goals. So hopefully these two programs will help us to answer these questions.
But this new Canadian law really makes me think that the Canadian government is heading one direction in terms of, you know, the possibility of using marijuana as a therapy, and the U.S. government, at least the federal government, is going in quite the other if they're trying to revoke the licenses of doctors who encourage their patients to, or revoke the prescribing licenses of doctors who are encouraging their patients to consider marijuana. Any thoughts about why those directions are diverging?
Well, I can't speak for what's happening in the U.S., but I can say that here in Canada, our health ministers have understood that it is very important to take a compassionate and reasonable approach to trying to address the problem. For years, patients have been pressuring government to allow access for medicinal use, and this was but yet government understands that we still need further research before we can certainly accept that marijuana may be a medicinal substance. So they developed sort of a two-pronged policy which allows patients access while supporting further research, and I feel that that is a very compassionate approach.
All right. Mary Lynch, thank you very much for that that update from Canada.
You're welcome.
Mary Lynch is Associate Professor of Psychiatry, Anesthesia, and Pharmacology at Dalhousie University and Director of Research in the Pain Management Unit of Queen Elizabeth II Health Sciences Center in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I'd like to return to the guests that we've been speaking to this hour, Billy Martin at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, Igor Grant is at the University of California at San Diego, and John Benson is with the Oregon Health and Sciences University in Portland. And Dr. Martin, if I may, as we were just hearing, there's a need for controlled or maybe controlled clinical trials. Now, in a controlled clinical trial, you give a drug and you give a placebo. And I've always wondered how you get something that you light with a match and inhale that you can actually have as a believable placebo with a placebo cigarette versus a marijuana cigarette.
Oh, it's very difficult, but there are ways that you can do it. One way is to look, as we call a dose response relationship. You can look at different marijuana preparations, those that contain small quantities of THC to those that contain large quantities, and if you get a dose response relationship, that's one way to address it. The other, of course, is that you can remove the cannabinoids from the plant, and so then you have a control cigarette that doesn't have the active constituents in it. The other way is to do crossover studies, or as we say, double dummy design, whereby you could, or we can, and studies are ongoing, where a patient smokes something, they also take a pill, and there can be a pill, the pill can contain the active constituent THC, or a placebo. The plant can contain either the active constituent or not. So there are ways that you can design them, but it's certainly not easy. But the issue is we're really lacking even many of the straightforward studies that I think is reasonable to do initially, and that is to have a patient smoke and then measure some parameters in them. We don't always know whether or not that's a direct or indirect or placebo effect, but many of those very straightforward studies haven't been done in a closely monitored fashion.
Dr. Benson, when you did your report in 1999, did you have the same feeling, like there were some very basic research programs or research studies that hadn't been done yet?
Well, the basic science was admirable in the last 20 years or so. Dr. Martin and others have contributed enormously to our understanding of these receptors in the brain, where they are situated, and the appropriate functions for those centers in the brain that are affected. The study found a big lack of controlled trials or other scientific approaches to clinical use. We were subjected to a great many surveys and anecdotal kinds of experience. We actually had three workshops at which perhaps 200 patients presented their stories to us, and I'm empathetic with the doctor from San Francisco because many of the patients, it seemed to me, were either misdiagnosed or had not had standard therapy, and I would hope in his particular case he could convince patients, one, to get a correct diagnosis and to have standard approved therapy. But yes, we lacked a good many good trials. There were good trials for pain, using comparing, I should say, drugs like codeine with both THC and smoked marijuana, and there were some for the nausea and vomiting of chemotherapy, particularly platinum, which uniformly causes vomiting, and that's not a subjective symptom. And those trials were very helpful and encouraging. So I'm delighted to hear both Dr. Grant and Dr. Lynch's progress since 99. It's exactly what the Institute of Medicine study recommended.
Okay, I'd like to welcome our callers to join this conversation. Our number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And let's go to Mike in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm calling because I have a concern that cannot be ignored in such a forum. I've been diagnosed and recommended to and a lot by doctors both at Cornell Medical School, Harvard, and University of Arizona to have a medical condition that requires that I not be exposed to marijuana, even in trace amounts. Even what comes through a plaster wall with paint on it, just seeping through the wall, is enough to cause me very serious illness. And I'm also almost blind, so it's very hard for me to avoid it if someone's walking down the street using it. And if any kind of forum exists where people are considering legalizing it, even to a limited extent, what is being done to protect people who have to avoid it? And also, once Pandora's box is open, it's very hard to make it illegal again. You know, once you've this is one reason that the government has been hesitant to legalize it, is because once you bring it out, it's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle.
Mike, thanks for your call. Dr. Grant, perhaps you have a thought about this?
Yeah, I think the thing to emphasize is that the reason the smoked root is used right now for some of the clinical trials, at least the ones we're conducting in California, is that at the moment it is the most efficient way to deliver cannabis molecules into the body. The absorption from the stomach and from the gastrointestinal tract is not terrific of these substances, or more accurately, they may be absorbed, but because the liver is very efficient and our fat cells are very good at sopping up these sort of fat-soluble chemicals.
Dr. Grant, I keep seeming to do this to you, but I have 1 second. This won't take long. I just need to remind people I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay, go ahead.
That's fine.
Just the luck of the draw. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying that the reason the smoked root is being used is because at the moment there aren't very good alternatives to administer cannabis compounds in a way that is predictable and reliable. I think that if the studies on smoked cannabis indicate there is a benefit, there will very quickly be a movement forward to finding alternative ways of delivering. I'll give you two examples. One example would be to use botanical cannabis and formulate it in some fashion, such as into a spray nebulizer that can be sprayed into the mouth or inhaled in some fashion without smoking it, which then would provide the necessary absorption. Another more likely approach in the future will be the development of novel compounds that mimic whatever it is the beneficial actions of cannabinoids are, and probably Dr. Martin could actually say more about that aspect.
What about that, Dr. Martin?
Well, there is, I think I agree with Dr. Grant, and there's quite a bit of activity ongoing in several laboratories and in several pharmaceutical companies to try to develop an inhaled form of THC. Dr. Grant is correct in the fact that there's Marinol that's available. Helps quite a number of people. It's an excellent drug. It does have some limitations, as Dr. Grant pointed out. It has a relatively slow onset of action, some variability, but it's a very beneficial drug. But there would be some benefit into having an inhaled form. So I see that as being something on the horizon pretty quickly in the next few years. It's going to take a little bit longer, but for us in the scientific community, what's most exciting is that with the discovery of this naturally occurring system, there are a lot of targets in that system whereby we can develop new medications and achieve the same thing without using a smoked plant material.
Okay. We're talking this hour about marijuana and its use as a medicine, but right now we have to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. A brief program note, join host Neil Conan on the next Talk of the Nation for a look at how doctors and patients are learning to communicate better. Plus, your letters. Can beer really drive away mosquitoes? That's next week on Talk, next Monday, I guess, on Talk of the Nation. This hour, we're talking about marijuana with Billy Martin of the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, Igor Grant of the University of California at San Diego, and John Benson at the Oregon Health and Sciences University in Portland. And let's go back to our callers and talk with Thomas from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm a non-smoker and a non-marijuana user. I'm calling because I've met people who have suffered diseases such as MS and who have been marijuana users and or marijuana advocates that is smoking marijuana, and I believe these people, because of their personalities, were probably addicted to smoking cigarettes before smoking marijuana, and also it's led me to believe that there may be in fact a link between MS, cancer, and or other serious diseases and marijuana itself.
Well, that's an interesting point. Any evidence for that that you're aware of, Dr. Grant?
Not that I'm aware of. In fact, it's possible that the cannabinoids have some immunomodulatory effects. That is, they may actually be helpful in dampening down autoimmune responses such as may occur in rheumatoid arthritis or conditions like that. Again, that's an area that ought to be studied more in the future. But I'm not aware of anything specific on that.
Tom, Dr. Martin or Dr. Benson?
I'm not aware of any evidence that smoking marijuana would lead to a pathology like MS. I mean, certainly you would expect that if anything it would help MS because it does suppress the immune system, and MS is an immune disorder. The major adverse effects from smoking marijuana, particularly chronically long term, has really been adverse effects on the lung. I think it's the most prominent. There are other aspects of cognitive function and reproduction, and those are relatively controversial. So I don't know of any evidence.
Okay.
For
all right. Okay. Thank you on that, Dr. Benson. Let's go to Jessica in Iowa. Welcome to the show, and what's your question?
Thank you. As a young person and a sufferer of severe chronic back pain, I'm wondering what the long-term effects are of smoking marijuana. As I said, I suffer from chronic pain, and I'm always looking for, you know, different remedies or, you know, I'm not sure what the word is I'm looking for, to help with the pain. My second question is simply out of college student curiosity, which is, how long does marijuana or its effects stay in the system?
Interesting. Jessica, I hope you're not driving a car. It makes me nervous hearing you go like that.
I'm fine, actually.
Okay. All right. Sounds like a cell phone. I thought maybe you're in a car. Dr. Grant, you started, Dr. Martin, you were starting to say something about lung effects. Maybe you can talk about the long-term medical consequences.
Well, and I think Dr. Benson can elaborate. This is an issue that we addressed in the IOM report, and the fact that there's a lot of unanswered questions about the long-term use of marijuana. It depends upon the individual, how much is used. Clearly, there's some adverse effects. And in the IOM report, it was very clearly recommended that medical marijuana should be recommended for a relatively short period of time, and particularly in terminally ill patients, patients where there's a specific a pathology, you can identify it. But there are obviously individuals that have reported relief of back pain with smoked marijuana. So the issue, and I'm sure Dr. Benson would agree and Dr. Grant would be, for Jessica to seek medical attention and to try standard therapies and see if those work first, and if medical marijuana would be a last resort.
I would worry about a young person with a chronic symptom getting into smoking for a long period of time. Dr. Martin has correctly indicated our concern over smoking. The same sorts of tars and other chemicals in tobacco smoke are present in marijuana smoke, and there are cellular changes, even genetic changes, in the lining cells of the bronchi that in humans that worry us over chronic use. And out of compassion, as he suggested, we did allow that terminal cases might use smoked marijuana for up to 6 months. One would hope that a young person wouldn't get started on a smoking regime for a chronic symptom. And it also reinforces the need for better delivery system, one that's more accurate, that delivers a specific dose of a specific substance, and one has high hopes for either nebulization or inhalers as a solution to this.
Okay. Dr. Grant, there was also part of that question about how fast the effects come on. I think that was the question.
Well, the how quickly the effects come on, of course, is related to how the material is introduced in the first place. From smoking, for example, one can have effects come on very rapidly within, you know, minutes, and peak effects in a half an hour, that type of thing. from taking a medicine like Marinol by mouth, it might, take 30 minutes or an hour to begin getting the effects, and 3 or 4 hours to get a peak effect.
Oh yes,
so it's variable that way. I think the other part of the question may be how long does marijuana hang around?
Right,
you can detect excretion of marijuana for many, many days and sometimes weeks. But whether at that point there are, for example, cognitive effects, I think is not known. I think the best information we have is that probably within some number of days after people have stopped smoking, the cognitive effects begin resolving. So,
all right. Well, thanks for your question. Let's go to Joseph in Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. I have cancer and I'm on chemotherapy, and I was actually given Marinol, and it worked, extremely well for the nausea, the vomiting, the appetite, and it made me quite high, I must say. I didn't like that at all. But the point is, it seems like it's the same thing as marijuana. It's the same chemical. I know it's in synthetic form, but still it seems to be the same thing. I don't understand, number one, other than the possible length of time for it to work, what's the difference? And also, there are plenty of opiates that people are taking, and yet no one's saying we need to legalize opium. So I don't understand, what's the difference?
A tough question. Maybe Dr. Benson, do you want to tackle that?
I'm glad that he's getting a good result. Many patients complain of a kind of dysphoria or unpleasant feeling from the oral administration, whether it's Marinol or even the brownies that are baked with marijuana leaf, and feel sluggish or hungover the next day even after ingesting Marinol. And so his experience is a very favorable one. The difference is, or another difference might be, according to advocates for smoked marijuana, is that in Marinol, one only gets synthetic THC, the single cannabinoid, whereas in the smoke, there may be a balanced proportion in some natural fashion of several cannabinoids that modulate each other, so to speak. And one would hope that in future pharmacologic kinds of studies, one might examine that presumed balance among the cannabinoids.
I need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joseph, I would like to ask you a question. You described feeling high.
Well, I had never smoked marijuana before.
Well, that's why I wanted to get you to describe what feeling high meant, and then I'm going to ask the doctors if there's a description that is universally agreed upon, because it seems a little bit of a general statement. But tell me what it was for you.
Well, actually, I wanted to clarify. It worked very well for the nausea and the vomiting and the appetite, but I actually, because of the, as the doctor mentioned, dysphoria and so on, I was extremely uncomfortable with it, and I hated it. I never wanted to take it again, although the accompanying literature does say don't stop taking it if you have these effects, because it sort of build up a little bit of resistance after 2 or 3 days. The point is, as far as your question is, I did, as I said, I felt very paranoid and dysphoric, as they say, and just generally, wasn't in touch with reality. I couldn't tell what was real and what wasn't. So I want to make that clear. I did not like it as far as that goes, but don't a lot of people who smoke marijuana have those same exact reactions? I don't understand, why that means that necessarily marijuana is better as far as that goes.
Well, Joseph, let me put that question to perhaps Dr. Grant. What's your experience there? Certainly some people report a positive experience from marijuana.
Well, I think the there are some general effects that we can talk about, and then I think there are some individual effects as well. The general effects really range from certain physiological changes that are seen in almost everybody, such as heart rate going up and the eyes getting a little bit bloodshot, and also changes in cognitive functioning, such as your sense of time changes. There may be changes in perception, things seeming brighter or not as bright. There can be also changes in mood in some people. Most people experience either a calming or sedating effect. But then there are a subgroup of people who have other effects as well, and those include what were just described. Some people become very anxious. Some people get suspicious, frightened, paranoid, and so forth. So those effects can occur, but they tend to be uncommon, at least in the literature that we've surveyed.
But has there been any comparison of Marinol to marijuana?
In terms of those side effects?
In terms in general, has there been any studies done comparing the efficacy of Marinol versus marijuana?
Those studies are very limited. I don't know whether Dr. Benson and Dr. Martin, who did the IOM report, can say anything more. I can't speak to having surveyed that systematically myself.
I think in terms of pain, have been direct comparisons between THC and smoked marijuana compared to placebos and codeine.
I see. And Dr. Martin?
There are a lot of similarities between smoked marijuana and THC. I think a very important factor is expectation. With either THC when it's given intravenously, for example, and when marijuana is smoked. And expectation and experience with the drug plays a very important part. And the results is very different in a medical setting frequently than it is in a recreational setting. So not only is it individual variability and how people respond to the substance, the pharmacology of marijuana is extremely complex, as Dr. Grant has just described. And so the effects, the result is very different in individuals, the setting, and so forth.
Okay, Joseph, thanks very much for your call, and to my guests, and to our listeners, I'm afraid that's all the time we have this hour. I'm trying to imagine a day when a third-party payment for marijuana is on the horizon, but maybe that's still a few years off. So my guests this hour are Billy Martin, who is the professor and chair in the Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology at the Medical College of Virginia. Igor Grant is professor of psychiatry and director of the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research at the University of California at San Diego. John Benson is professor and dean emeritus at the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland and was co-principal investigator of the 1999 report by the Institute of Medicine, Marijuana and Medicine, Assessing the Scientific Base. Thanks to all of you for joining me. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. If you have comments or questions, you can write to us at Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. You can also email us at our internet address, which is scifry@npr.org, or surf over and visit us at our website, www.sciencefriday.com. Ira Flato will be back next week. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.